Welcome to The Drummer's Pathway, the podcast about music, life, and the creative process.
Hello, I'm Michael Scott, and welcome to The Drummer's Pathway podcast. This episode features part two of my conversation with drummer Nate Morton. On this episode, we continue our discussion about his experiences on The Voice and Rockstar series. We also talk about his perspectives around finding success in the music industry and working to find balance in your life. If you haven't yet had the opportunity, be sure to go back and check out episode 39, which features part one of our interview. Now, let's get started with part two of my conversation with drummer Nate Morton. One of the things that I've heard you talk about frequently in many, many interviews is all about your experiences working on the Rockstar series, Rockstar NXS, Rockstar Supernova. And now you've been probably, I think, right, you're 23, 24 seasons of The Voice now that you're getting on. So you're kind of known as the TV guy.
I'm laughing because that's what Grant calls me. My instructor Grant calls me the TV guy. And I'm like, what do you mean? I'm not the TV guy. Yeah. And he's like, look, you've done this show, you've done this, this show. You're the TV guy. Own it. And I'm like, I'm not the TV guy. But anyway, go on.
But without going through the whole story about, you know, how all of those things came about, because you've told that story many, many times. If we look back at the Rockstar series, the NXS and the Supernova ones, what are some situations or experiences from that time that were memorable for you?
That's another good question. You're good. You're piling up points right now, Michael. So, experiences from that time. It's funny because when you're actually in the moment, it doesn't necessarily, in my experience anyway, you don't necessarily realize it in the moment. And so it's in retrospect that I look back and I think, like, wow, my job was driving off and on the CBS studios parking lot and going and playing a TV show. You know, like, looking back on, I think, like, wow, that's kind of crazy. Or like, you know, oh, you know, hey, Nate, what you doing today? Oh, nothing big, just hanging out with Tommy Lee, you know, having a couple drinks. Like, what? That's not like a normal existence. Yeah. You know what I mean? So some things like that. One sort of funny thing that happened was, I very rarely get recognized. Of the handful of times that I have been recognized, I've had the good fortune. This is great. I love that. You'll get a kick out of this. Of the rare few times that I have been recognized, frequently, I'm with one of my kids, which I love. I kind of, hey, man, I love you on that show. Oh, wow. Hey, thanks a bunch. Okay, cool. What's your name? Matt. Okay, Nate. Nice to meet you, Matt. Okay, man, I'm going to be watching you this week. Okay, great. And then they walk away, and I kind of nudge my kid, and I go, see, dad's kind of cool. One time I was walking, this is just on the subject of being recognized. And like I said, I'm rarely recognized. But in the Rockstar days, since you mentioned it, I had, you know, long dreads. And I frequently was wearing a bandana on the show. And, you know, so I sort of did look, let's say, slightly more recognizable, maybe.
Yes.
So I'm walking into a mall in my neighborhood. And I'm walking in, and the doors that I'm walking into are, they're these glass sliding double doors. And they lead onto the food court. And where the food court is, there's a table of a guy who's facing the door and a girl who has her back to the door. And as I'm approaching the door, and it's glass, so I see them and I'm looking at them and I see him mouth the words, and I can't mouth them because this is all audio, so you won't hear it, so I have to say the words, but I see him mouth the words, "It's the drummer from Rockstar." And he kind of points at it's the drummer from Rockstar. And as I'm walking in the door, because I read his lips, and as I'm walking in the door, she kind of like turned around and I was like, you know, I just kind of waved, "Hi." So that was a memorable moment from that show. At one point, here's another memorable moment. The memorable moments from that show are, like, it's funny, the things that are sticking out in my head, that because they're not musical things. They're things outside of the actual playing of the songs on the show. And if you gave me a minute, I'm sure that I would come up with more. But one of the things that I have a scar to show for it, and I just posted about this on socials not too long ago. So when we were playing on that show, I'm playing and I'm in, you know, rock mode. And so if I ever broke a stick, I would wing it backwards over my head like I'm playing an arena or something, right? And when in fact we're in the little TV studio, but I would wing it backwards over my head. Yeah, rock and roll. Grab another stick. Play. So we're coming up to, we're playing, it's the finale. It's the finale show. So they come up to me and they say, Nate, listen, there is a giant video wall behind you. There's a $250,000 video wall behind you. Do not throw any sticks behind your head. And I go, okay, no problem. And they go, no, Nate, you don't understand. Do not throw any sticks behind your head. And I go, okay, we're good. We're cool. I'm cool. Well, we're playing the show. And sure enough, I have a stick. I hit the bell of the ride cymbal. It snaps the bead off the stick. And I go to throw it, as I do, force of habit. I go to throw it. And in that motion, I remember, oh, no, not behind me. So I throw the stick straight up. I grab another stick. I'm playing the ride. And literally, the stick, it's almost like it was frozen in frozen animation, you know, above me. The stick comes down and stabs me in the back of my hand. Now, obviously, this is audio. You could see this, but I have this scar on the back of my hand to prove it. And I sort of, you know, start bleeding all over the drum set. It was a very rock and roll moment. But yes, that's another memorable moment. Me stabbing myself in the hand. I couldn't do it again if I was trying. Nate, break a stick. Throw it straight up, time it perfectly to grab another stick, be back on the ride, have that previous stick come down, point side down, and stab you in the back of your hand, drawing blood. I could try that for the next 15 years and never achieve it.
I think we've all had those moments throughout our career.
Hilarious.
Looking at the multiple seasons that you've done on The Voice, same sort of thing. Is there any particular moments or experiences that have really stood out for you?
Okay, so we're doing this Rorschach style. Like, you're putting up the Rorschach test, and I'm just telling you what I see. So in this, not Rorschach, that's maybe the wrong one. What's the word? Word association. It's almost like word association. I'm just saying the first thing that pops into my head. I'm downstage, which basically means I'm not on the main stage riser, but rather downstage on a smaller riser, on a smaller set, and I'm tweaking some little things for a performance with a quote-unquote A-lister. Like, and wait till I get to the end of the story, because this person is an A-lister of A-listers. So I'm tweaking my drums, I'm doing this, and I feel, you know, someone sort of standing behind me, kind of over my shoulder. And I turn and I look, and she says, oh, I didn't want to interrupt you, drummer man. I just wanted to introduce myself. My name is Dolly. And I look at her and I go, I know who you are. The universe knows who you are. But that was a pretty cool moment that, like, Dolly Parton would have taken the time to literally go to every single musician in the band and introduce herself and say, she wouldn't have said I'm stoked, but she would have said, I'm, you know, happy to be on the show, you know. That would be one moment that pops into my head first and foremost. Again, you know, some of these are not musical moments. I remember being on a drum riser that was 19 feet high, and it was extremely terrifying. And incidentally, it was so distracting that I never played the song right. I think I finally played the song right when we did it in the show. It was a Christmas. It was near the live shows, and it was getting near to the end of the season, so it would have been getting close to Christmas, and the entire stage set was a giant Christmas tree, and I was basically at the top of the Christmas tree. And so I'm on a riser that's 19 feet high, so if I fall backwards, like, pff, lights out for Nate. So that was one moment. What else? I never realized until being on The Voice, you know, when they show typically rock concerts and they have those giant fireballs, like those things, they're freaking hot. Oh my. You can be 30 feet away, and when one of those things goes, like, you feel it, like, singe the hairs on the back of your neck. So that I discovered from being on the show. That was pretty memorable, the first time that ever happened. So, yeah, fortunately, I haven't fallen off of anything, and I haven't stabbed myself in the hand on The Voice. I mean, there's still time, but yeah, I'll come back. If something else pops into my head that's memorable, you know, I mean, it goes without saying, it's been a long time on that show, a dozen years now. And I do try to stop myself and kind of go like, this is pretty cool. You play on a TV show. Like, right on. High five myself, you know. But it's very easy for it to kind of go by pretty blur like and not always notice it. Kiss being on the show was a highlight because that's a band that I've listened to and loved from the time that I was 6 years old.
And you worked with Paul Stanley.
Paul Stanley. That's right. That's right. One of the most fun gigs I've ever done. And Paul is one of the most... You ever meet people that are your idol or that are heroes of yours? You ever meet hero of yours? And then when you walk away from that encounter, you kind of think to yourself, wish I didn't meet that guy. He's kind of a jerk.
Even if it wasn't necessarily a bad experience, sometimes if it was just a different experience than you expected,
sure.
you can walk away and you can say, hey, they were really nice, but that's not who I envisioned they would be. And so that sure. Even just that can throw you off.
Sure. Well, with Paul, he is so cool and so down to earth. And a lot of the time I think to myself of the people that I work with, I think like they're the artist. Don't get fooled. They're not your friend. Like you're working together. You have a working relationship and they're the artist. Paul is actually a friend. There are a handful of artists that I've worked with that I consider friends. And he is one of them. I can't say enough cool things about Paul. And he's hilarious. He's hilarious. And I don't know if you would necessarily get that. I don't know if you necessarily, if you just see him, you know, without actually being in a room, for example, like, what did he say to me one time? I said, it was basically the rock star house band, right? And Paul Stanley. And so I said to Paul, I said, man, Paul, the rock star house band with you as the front person, this is the best band I've ever been in. He goes, yeah, I bet this is the best band you've ever been in. Yeah, no, he's hilarious.
One of the things that I've always heard about Paul Stanley as well is that he has an exceptionally high level of professionalism and expectations in terms of the people that he works with.
Well, and you can only be that way if you hold yourself to that level. You can only expect a high level of performance from those around you if you yourself are giving a high level of performance. And this is my... If you know only one thing about Paul Stanley, it's this story that I'm about to share. If you know only one thing, it's this story. We were rehearsing, and we were at a rehearsal studio called SIR. And Paul is screaming his head off. He is going for it. Like he's performing like there's 100,000 people in the room. And Paul, musical director, after we finished that particular thing, says to Paul Stanley, hey, Paul, you know, we're going to be in here rehearsing for like a couple of weeks. I wouldn't want you to blow your voice out. You can probably take it easy and sort of just mark some of these. Paul Stanley goes, look, man, I got two speeds, on and off. And in that moment, I just went, that's why you're Paul Stanley. That's why you're Paul Stanley. Like 10 people, 10,000 people, 110,000 people, same output, same energy, same attention, same intensity, you know? And like I said, it was one of those moments where I was really, I'm standing in a room with a hero of mine. I was dressing like the guy when I was 6 years old. I was making Kiss costumes out of like boxes and stuff around the house. I was wearing my mom's high heel Agner boots around the house, pretending to be Paul Stanley. I was cutting cardboard guitars out, you know, when I wasn't banging on, you know, throwing together drum sets. So it was just, you know, that was a really great experience. That was a really great experience. And again, circling all the way back to the beginning of our conversation, when you said, where does the joy come from? In that moment, I was 5 years old. I was 6 years old playing to Dynasty, which is the first record I ever owned. Came out in 1978, so I guess it would have been 7, because I was born in 71. So that record came out in 78, and I was playing along to it. So on my little drum set, playing what I, you know, you get it. I mean, so yeah, so that was a great experience.
I've been finding great joy recently over the last few weeks of going on to your YouTube page and watching your voice drum cam videos. And one of the things that I love about them, which once again goes back to the beginning of our conversation, is your level of professionalism, your level of joy that you're getting from this, and just how articulate and how polished everything is. And I know that in a lot of these situations, you don't have a lot of time to put all of this stuff together. So there's some pretty high expectations and standards that you have to obtain. And even though you're doing this all the time, it's probably one of those jobs that doesn't always get easier. You still have to always maintain that high level of professionalism.
Okay. What's your question in there, Michael?
My question is really just, what's your approach in these situations to ensure that you're always ready to go and perform at such a high level?
Interesting. So, first of all, thank you. I'm glad that it appears as though I am prepared. I'm glad that it appears as though I am professional, and I'm glad it appears as though I know what I'm doing. We're talking about Paul just a moment ago, and I don't know if this is the answer to your question necessarily, but in terms of my overall, let's call it power output, right? Like my overall kilowatt hours that I'm outputting for energy and driving the band, for whatever reason, I can't phone it in. Like my DNA doesn't let me phone it in. So when you see, like, when I approach a rehearsal, I'm like, okay, it's rehearsal. It's just rehearsal. Take it easy. Chill out. Let's go at like 45% max capacity. We'll be good. And then I look back and I see a video of it and like the sticks are behind my head and I'm like losing my mind. So it's just, man, five-year-old caveman. I can't not do it. And in terms of things getting harder or easier, I'm not going to lie. I mean, the first time I did a TV show, the first time I did, let's say, for example, Rockstar, and I'm looking at the song list, and there's 12 songs for us to learn, and I spend the preceding, like before the first rehearsal, I spend the preceding, let's just say, several days listening to those songs, learning those songs, writing out, like, quote unquote, proper charts, right? Actual notes on paper, these charts. And I walk in and we've got 12 songs to do. And that day started at, let's just say, 8 a.m. And then it took us until 8 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night to get through learning those 12 songs as a band and being able to play them effectively. Well, now, as it is the same core unit, it's Paul Merkovich, Sasha Krivtsov, myself, same core unit from Rockstar, now playing on The Voice. 12 songs, like, I mean, 12 songs is like a like 2 hours, maybe, if we have to get through 12 songs. So, okay, I'll say 2.5 hours. And the way that, what that looks like is, we listen down to the song one time. And in fairness, we're playing cut down versions. We're playing a 3-minute version of a song or 2.5-minute version of a song. We'll listen down to that 2.5-minute version of a song one time. Maybe Paul needs to dial some keyboard sound. Maybe Justin needs to grab the right guitar. Maybe Sasha needs to grab the right bass. I don't need to grab anything. I play the same drum set for everything. We play down that 2.5-minute song. Paul says, does anyone feel compelled to play that song again? We invariably say no, because we want to get through this and get out of here. And we move on. So it's not crazy that in an hour we play through 6 songs or we learn 6 songs as a band. So that process has actually become more streamlined, let's say. I don't know if it's easier or if it's become more streamlined. So there you go. I mean, that's my kind of roundabout. I don't at this point, I'm not even sure the question that you ask anymore. Did I even come remotely close to answering whatever you asked?
Yes. Yes, you did. You also recently had the great pleasure of playing in the band for the Grammy Awards. And so my question to you with regards to that was, what was it like working with bass legend Leland Sklar?
Okay, let me clarify just briefly, and you are not alone, and I, you may know the difference between the two, but for your listeners who may not know the difference between the two, I actually played the Grammy premiere show. So the Grammy Awards that they broadcast at night that feature, you know, the album of the year, song of the year, babidi boo boo, that's the nighttime show where they give away about 17 or 18 Grammys. There are almost another 80 Grammys that get given out in a show that takes place in the afternoon from around 12 to 4 called the Grammy Premiere Show. And so that is the band that I was in with Leland Sklar. We played the Grammy Premiere Show. Not to get it confused, because a lot of people don't realize those are two separate performances. Or two separate shows. Leland is... Well, okay, first of all, the guy's a legend. Like, the guy's a legend. The guy's played on more records than many people have in their entire record collection. So he's a legend. Let's just start with that. He's also sewn into the tapestry of LA recording studio folklore. Like, he's that. I don't want to tell this story because I'm going to tell it. So at one point, I believe Leland had a bass with a switch on it. And if ever the producer was like, hey, Leland, your bass sounds a little bit fluffy, or your bass sounds a little bit this or that, or whatever. What do you think? He would go, oh, well, here, try this. And he would flip the switch, and he would play, and they go, ah, perfect. That was perfect. The switch was connected to nothing. You know? So, like, that's Leland. Like, he's a brilliant genius on multiple levels. He's hilarious. He's, speaking of being recognized, like, you can't walk down the sidewalk with the guy because he's a freaking celebrity on top of celebrity, right? And again, like I was saying earlier about Paul, it's one of those things where you're like, I'm meeting this person for the first time. I hold this person in super high esteem. I really hope this isn't an uncomfortable or, you know, whatever encounter. Leland is the sweetest, nicest, coolest, easiest to be around dude. I mean, and you would be very hard-pressed to find any musician to say anything else. Anyone that's ever worked with him or ever known him, you'd be very hard-pressed to find anyone who would say anything other than that. He's hilarious. He has a book. I don't know if you know this or not, but he has a book. It's like a coffee table book.
Yes.
And it's a collection of photos of people flipping him off. He would go to take the picture and he'd go, okay, now flip me off. And it's like, what? I don't want to flip you off. And he'd flip him off. And it's just so funny because he's got this like page after page after page of people flipping him off. And the beauty of it is the utter irony. No one in sincerity would ever flip off Leland's car. You know what I mean? It's like flipping off Santa Claus. It's like, you know, so no one would ever do that in a million years. So the irony, he's like maybe the only person in the world who could pull that off. So, yeah, Leland, man, that whole band is ridiculous. That whole band is crazy. And I just look around and I'm like, am I really in this room right now? Like, is this really what I'm doing right now? Playing with this collection of absolutely insane players. So, yeah.
But you earned it.
Nice of you to say. Thank you. Thank you. I have spent a lot of hours trying to get halfway okay at this thing that I do.
You're also a dedicated family man with a wife and kids. How do you find and manage the life balance between work and family these days?
It's an ever-moving target. And some days I do better than others. So a perfect day for me is maybe I teach a few drum lessons in the morning, and then maybe I take my two daughters to the mall so they can go shopping, right? Or hang out with their friends or whatever they're doing, whatever. And then maybe at the end of the day, I get to sit on the couch and talk to my wife for 20 minutes or watch a movie. That's like a perfect day. That being said, it is, as I said, a moving target. I have a buddy of mine. His name is Tony. I spent a lot of time talking about this, actually. I got a buddy named Tony. Tony DiAugustine. Outstanding drummer. And also, sweetest guy in the world. And one day I was talking to Tony. This is when I had not moved to LA yet. So I would have been in my like mid-20s, somewhere in that ballpark. And I was out here doing some sort of gig. And I hung out with Tony. And I said, Tony, you know, this is when I'm thinking about moving to LA. Tony, what would you say is the hardest thing about being a professional drummer? And I'm thinking, or I think I said professional musician. And I'm thinking like he's going to say, oh, making sure your gear is in tip-top shape. Oh, being a versatile player. Oh, having great reading skills. And Tony said, balance. The hardest thing about being a professional musician is balance. And I went, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, totally, balance. Right, cool, right. And in my head, I was like, balance? What do you mean balance? What are you talking about? Like, I have no idea what that means. And every day, week, month, year, decade after that, it became more and more apparent what that meant. You know, because I said to him in the moment, I said, a balance between what? And he said, a balance between everything. And it truly is a balance between everything. And it's funny, in my life, my entire life is constantly trying to create a balance between everything. So to the point earlier when I said, yeah, there were a lot of times when I took the lower paying gig because I thought it would be more fun. And that's even the thing, right? So you're balancing, do I take the higher paying gig that I'm going to dread or the lower paying gig that's more fun? Okay, I'm on tour, so I'm getting paid. So I'm making a little bit of money, but I'm too busy on tour to have fun enjoying any of that money. Okay, I'm home, I'm off tour, I'm not working, I have time to do stuff, but I'm broke because I'm not working. So then you fret about, you know, finding the next opportunity to play. And to your point, you know, I'm busy, so this is great, and I'm having a great time and great career success playing on The Voice. Meanwhile, you know, I haven't seen my 12-year-old daughter in 5 days. So, you know, so it's just an ongoing thing, and I don't have the answer. The answer to how do you create that is constantly be aware of what that is and constantly be striving to create that. That's the only answer that I have. Is because it is a moving target. And the way that one person creates that is going to look different than the way that another person creates it.
What are the other passions in your life aside from music when you need to step away to just rejuvenate yourself?
Man, so when I would tour, I don't know if I'd elevate this to call it a passion, but when I would tour, I would study chess. I would always bring my chess board and I would bring my books and I would study chess. So I would sit in the back lounge with my chess board as we're rolling from, you know, Roanoke, Virginia to Philadelphia. And I would set up my board and I would set up positions and I would study chess. When we played in certain cities where I knew that I could go and play some chess with some, you know, guys in the park or whatever, I would kind of know where to go. I would know, like, in New York City, it's, you know, freaking 4th Street, 4th Avenue down there in the Village. I would know that in San Francisco, it's like 5th Avenue. I would know that in, where was it? In Atlanta, it was like Woodruff Park, I think it was what the park is called there. So chess would be my other sort of thing. But, I mean, it just so happens that I did kind of make my primary hobby slash passion into my career. So sadly, I don't know if I have another passion outside of playing drums. There's nothing that I'd rather. Sometimes I'm sitting in a rehearsal or it's a show day or it's whatever it is. It's a studio session. And maybe it's stretching into like hour 8, hour 9, hour 10. And I always remind myself, you get to do this. My buddy Reggie Hamilton said that to me. Bass player, outstanding bass player, outstanding friend. And I was in Las Vegas, and we were on the phone, and I was in my hotel room, and I needed to get on the elevator, so I was going to lose reception. So I said, hey, Reggie, I got to go, because I have to go downstairs and go over and play the gig with Cher. And Reggie said, no, you get to go downstairs and go over and play the gig with Cher. And so I think about that now, and that's something that just, I think about it all the time. So when I'm in an 8-hour day or 9-hour or 10-hour more day, I just remind myself, like, I get to do this. And there's nothing that I'd rather do, you know, for 10 hours. I love movies. I'm a huge movie buff. I don't want to watch movies for 10 hours a day, 5 days a week. You know, and that's something that I love, right? But I'm happy to play drums for 10 hours a day, 5 days a week, 7 days a week sometimes. So, yeah, so I don't know. I mean, again, I don't know if this rises to be called a passion, but I'm kind of a car guy. That's an overstatement because I don't turn any wrenches on anything. But I'm a car enthusiast. Let's put it that way. I enjoy the car that I have, which is like a little sports car that I enjoy tooling around in. And I enjoy, you know, the opportunity to go to the go-kart track and do that thing. So, you know, so that's kind of me. I'm very boring. I'm very bored. Like, I want to be like, you know, what are your other passions? Well, you know, 2 years ago I scaled Mount Everest. I'm thinking about going back for a repeat. No, I don't have anything like that.
See, I'd rather watch the documentary of the guy scaling Mount Everest than be the guy scaling Mount Everest.
Sure. Absolutely.
Looking back to the earlier part of your career versus where you are now, how has your definition of success changed, or has it?
In the early part of my career, I had a certain list of things I wanted to do, right? Even if they weren't formally written down, I mean, I had certain things I had certain things that I wanted to do based off of certain things that my heroes were doing. Touring, for example. Recording, for example. Finding a way to be a successful musician in LA, for example. So sometimes I look around at my life and I go, I've got this pretty cool wife. She's kind of awesome. I've got this gaggle of kids. They're pretty cool. I have a neat little sports car that I like. I own a house. The bank owns the house. They're letting me live in it for a while. So I have this house in LA. I have a reasonable career. I've kind of done most of the things that I wanted to do. So now I'm kind of taking pleasure in sitting back and focusing less on my own career and watching, for example, my oldest son, Miles, who's 23, who just got a job as Nithya Raman. She's a California councilperson. Nithya Raman's, Los Angeles. She's a Los Angeles councilperson. Nithya Raman's policy director. So it's like I go, wow, look at this kid. And look at my other son, Brandon, who's 21, who's about to graduate. He's got another semester or so, but he's about to graduate from UCLA and the things that he's doing. I look at my 17-year-old Lachlan, who's a tennis kid, and watching the things that he does. So, you know, I'm focused more on like the people around me and watching them achieve now kind of than my own achievements. I realize that that seems to be the opposite of what I said earlier when I said I'm still working on things. And I am. I am still working on things. And I am still trying to grow as a musician. But in terms of pivotal achievements, I'm more now looking outward than inward, if that makes sense.
Now, you are a teacher, and we've already talked a lot about your experiences as an educator. What are some of the biggest lessons you've learned from your kids?
The main lesson that I learned from my kids is you have to let them find their own way. That's honestly my main lesson, because there was a time period in Miles's life. Here's the funny thing. So when we meet a kid, and they're, let's say, 5. Like, what's the first thing? So usually the first 2 questions that you ask a kid is, oh, hi, little Jimmy. How old are you? And like, if a kid had the mental wherewithal, they would go, Jesus Christ, can you please be more original? But little Jimmy will say, I'm 5. And then you go, and what do you want to be when you grow up? And again, if a kid had the mental faculty to do so, they would say, I don't freaking know. Yeah. I'm 5. How am I supposed to know what I want to be when I grow? Are you kidding? Right. So my point is, with Miles, my eldest boy, I was that way. I was like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to do when you graduate from high school? What are you going to do? What are you going to study? What are you going to be when you grow up? What are you going to, you know, we have to support yourself. And his mom would say to me, Nate, you're an anomaly. You are an anomaly. The fact that you knew what you wanted to do when you were 5 years old makes you the weirdo, not Miles. Miles is not the weirdo because he doesn't know what he wants to do. So after struggling with that forever and ever, I then watch him at the end of his high school career, his junior year, go off and win a national speech and debate title. And I go, oh, like first place. My kid is the best in the country at this particular speech and debate event. The next year goes off 4th place in a more competitive category. And I go, full scholarship to college. Oh, graduates college, now works at City Hall, you know, works at LA City Hall. So if I've learned something from my kids, it's the idea that I need to sort of sit back and let them be who they are and, you know, provide guardrails when necessary, but for the most part, kind of let them find their way. That's the biggest and most important thing probably that I've learned from my kids.
Now, you spend most of your career playing the music of others as in a support role. and you take great pride in that. But you've also released three of your own projects, which I have been blessed to get copies of. And my wife and I get great joy out of your Playground Philosophy album. It's a constant in our car since I've got this one, and we love it. So where does your creative side come into play these days with regards to your life as a professional musician?
Well, let me speak to that record for one moment. I don't even remember what year that was. Let's see, what year was that? That would have been not long after I moved to LA. So I'm going to say that would have been mid-2000s, somewhere in there. 4, 5, 6, somewhere. 2004, 5, 6, something like that. Maybe a little later. And at the time, to your point, I enjoy playing covers. I don't have a problem with it, you know. But I don't have any problem with it, actually. It's quite, In fact, when people ask me what I do for a living, when I tell them I'm a drummer, and they say, oh, what do you do? And I go, I'm in a cover band. It's true. I'm in a cover band. I mean, you know, we're highly visible, but we're a cover band nonetheless. And to quote my bass player, Sasha, by the way, Sasha always says, unless you wrote the song, you're in a cover band. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. You could be playing with Janet Jackson. You didn't write the song. You're covering whoever wrote that song and whoever recorded it, so you're playing cover band. Anyway, I digress. That record was born out of a certain amount of, you know, being told, like, oh, Nate, don't make it quite that funky. Or, oh, Nate, we don't really want this song to sound like it has a reggae influence. Oh, Nate, you know, whatever, right? Because in that role, to your point, you're in a role of support. So when I wrote that record, or when I put together that project, I just sort of went, I want to have absolutely no boundaries on anything. I don't want to have any boundaries in terms of what genre I want to explore. So as a result, there's a reggae tune on there. There's me trying to rap, which is just ridiculously ill-fated. But I said, like, whatever, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go for it. There's me trying to sing, which is even more ill-fated. So that's what that record was born out of. So the energy and everything and the subject matter on that record, you know, I didn't limit that either. So if you know the record, so there's like, yes, a song about my frustration with telephone solicitors.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's, you know, a song about a diet where I lose weight because
all dessert diet.
Desserts, exactly. And I cut out everything else. That was, by the way, I have to give her credit every time that song comes up. Actually, she's a fellow Canadian, but Lisa was, I was talking to this girl, Lisa. I met her years ago. I was on tour in Hamilton, of all places, right? I'm in Hamilton. Hamilton's in Ontario, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm in Hamilton, and she happened to be working at the venue where I happened to be playing, and we struck up a conversation, and she was eating a Snickers bar. And then 15 minutes later, she was eating like a cupcake. And then like 10 minutes later, she was eating some other piece of candy. And I was like, how do you eat like that? But you're like so slim. Like, she's a very slender girl. And she's the one who said, well, you know, if you only eat sweets and you cut out everything else, you lose weight. And so that's what inspired that song. That is what inspired that song. So where was I going with that? So you asked me in terms of creativity today. My opportunity to be creative today. Well, most recently, I did another record, which I think I sent to you, by the band is called Fraud Prophets. And that's me and, yes, my best friend, Sean Halley. And that record, yep, there it is. That record was born out of not frustration at all, but that record was basically Sean and I. The kernels of that record came together when Sean and I were in the Garudio. And I was sitting behind the drum set, and he had his guitar, and we put up, you know, a Pro Tool session. And it was very much like what's that sporting event? Fencing. It was very much like fencing. Ha, parry, ha, two shares, jab, this, that, right? And so it was very much that. So I would play some rando groove, and it's like, here, hey, okay, how about this, buddy? Here's some rando groove in 6. And he would go, okay, here's what I would do. Oh, but hey, why don't you do this? How about every other bar you play 6, but then the whole thing is actually in 5? Okay, I'll do that. Okay, hey, here's this up-tempo country train groove. What are you going to do now? Ha, ha, ha. Oh, okay, I'm going to go. Okay. And so that's how that record was formed, right? So that was probably the most recent sort of creative outlet where I was co-steering the ship, right? That's me and Sean. Lately, just myself, I find the opportunity to be creative when someone sends me something to record on, because that's just me in my room in here and I'm tracking drums. And depending on the project, I'm allowed certain creative leeway sometimes. And so I'll say, you know, hey, you hear that track like way buried in like the drum mix? Yeah, Nate, what is that? That's me playing, you know, with my brushes on, you know, top of my friggin' office chair or something. You know, whatever it is, right? And I realize that sounds kind of silly and like, you know, oh, that's not very creative. But that's kind of where I get to explore, you know? And that's probably the main place. You know what's actually funny? Teaching is a little bit of a creative outlet for me because I have to come up with ways to communicate certain ideas and concepts to people. So that's not always about like, oh, I've got this grand vision for this particular canvas. It's not exactly that. But at the same time, it is me saying like, what way can I approach this? Okay, that isn't quite getting it through. How can I shift gears? What's another way I can approach this? And so that is a situation where, you know, my degree of creativity comes into play as well.
If you could look back and pick, say, one or two examples in terms of the experiences that you have, what are some of the ones that have been most surprising or most satisfying?
Recording the record that I did with Sean, Fraud Prophets. A lot of the time I'll hear myself playing something and I'll think to myself, huh, this drummer sounds pretty cool. And someone will go, oh yeah, well that's you, Nate. That's you playing on, you know, the record that we did back in 2012. And I'll go, oh yeah, it's not that good. You know, so as soon as I realize it's me, I become less, you know, less impressed by it. The Fraud Prophets record that I did with Sean is a rare exception in the sense that I'm very proud of that record and I listen to it and I don't cringe. I can actually put that record on and listen to it for enjoyment. So that would be one experience that I had that's sort of profound and meaningful to me. So here is maybe the most pivotal moment in my life. Gee, Nate, overstate much? this is maybe the most pivotal moment of my life. And the moment, it was this. In high school, remember I told you I was in my high school, my rock band. We were in a rock band called Acamilli mm-hmm. in high school. And we played the Oakland Mills High School talent show. And that may be the first time that I ever played drum set on stage in front of people, period, let alone an auditorium full of all of my peers. And playing drums and having my peers, some of whom I knew, most of whom I didn't, screaming and cheering and applauding was like this crazy feeling. And I was 17 years old, I guess, or somewhere in that ballpark. And it's funny because one of my bandmates, who's a guy named Dave Siddick, who has gone on to be extremely successful, very successful record producer, had a band called TV on the Radio. Dave was the front person. Was Dave fronting or was he playing guitar at that point? He was playing guitar. And after we finished performing, he said to me, Nate, I could barely look at you because when I looked back at the drum set, all I saw was this glowing beam of light. And it's funny because that was the way it felt. It really felt that way. And that was the first time that I'd ever gotten that kind of response from anything that I had ever done. And so as much as I feel like from 5 years old, I wanted to be a musician and I wanted to play, in that moment, it really crystallized it, you know? It really took the idea. You know that scene in Superman where he takes a lump of coal and he crushes it between his hands so hard that he turns it into a diamond? Up to that point, the idea of being a professional musician was a lump of coal. And in that moment, it became a diamond. Can I just take this opportunity to say, I'm really good at analogies.
So I actually just want to flip this question around.
Sure.
And I want to say, when you look back throughout your career, what was the biggest disappointment?
What was the biggest disappointment? Interesting. I know you're going to edit this so you can tighten this up because I need to take a moment and think about this. The biggest disappointment. There were a couple of times that people said things to me that weren't what I needed to hear in that moment. And in that regard, so I heard a drummer one time playing a show and they were a name drummer and they were playing with a name artist. And so to me, I was probably in high school. I was either in high school or maybe I was, maybe it was the summer that I was about to transfer to Berkeley. And so I'm watching this player play. And at the end of their performance, I go to the edge of the stage. I motion them over. I shake hands. I say, it's really a pleasure to meet you. They say, thanks. And I go, I'm really excited because I'm about to go to Berklee College of Music because I want to be like you, essentially, is what I say. And in that moment, the person said to me, man, you don't have to go to Berklee to do this. And it was so disheartening. And disheartening is the wrong word, but it wasn't what I wanted to hear at that moment. I wanted to hear, good for you, further your education, work hard, study hard. You'll be doing a million kind of gigs like this. That's what I wanted to hear. And that's what I probably would say to someone if the roles were reversed and someone came to me. I don't see myself ever in a situation where I would discourage someone from seeking education or from seeking knowledge. I don't think I'd ever see myself in that scenario. So that would have been sort of a disappointing thing. Getting a rejection letter from, you know, Berklee College of Music when I first applied for a scholarship and them saying, we regret to inform you, but at this moment, nope. And I was like, ah. And so I'm not fully in this camp, but I am a little bit in the camp where, like, if you tell me I can't do it, I'm going to work harder to achieve it. And so flash forward, that first time entering Berklee, no scholarship, worked really hard, practiced really hard, collected a bunch of stuff that said that I was, you know, on the right path. And I went back and I applied again and I got a scholarship to go there. Now the second, my second or third semester. So, you know, so those were kinds of things. And I wouldn't say, I don't know if I'd use the term disappointed only because I usually try to find motivation in things that don't go the way that I want them to. So like being told no scholarship for you made me want a scholarship and work that much harder to achieve it. Or being told, you know, not important for you to necessarily raise your level of music education, I kind of went, oh yeah, you know, watch me. This is what I need to do. I'm going to do this. And that's all. So there's those things. Yeah. Oh, hey, how about this? This is not exactly what you're asking, but it's funny. It's an interesting story to me. Long story short, there's a very, like, the landing on Rockstar was very interesting. I had auditioned several months later, for lack of a better term, a big gig with a big artist. I had auditioned several months later for. It was going to be a retainer gig. I was so happy. I was like, oh man, if I get this gig, that's, you know, relief, money, and it's a big gig. Blah, 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 blah. Well, I didn't get the gig. Now, the reason why it's important to share that it's a retainer gig. Had it been a retainer, well, it was a retainer gig. Had I gotten the gig, when the audition for Rockstar came around, I would have been on retainer with that artist and therefore unable to audition for Rockstar. Had I not auditioned for Rockstar, I would not have met Paul Merkovich. I would not have played with Sasha and Paul and myself as a rhythm section for the first time together. I would not have done the first season of Rockstar. I would not have done the second season of Rockstar. I would not have done all the various recordings. I would not have done Cher. I would not have done Paul Stanley. So you see what I'm saying? So in that moment when I didn't get that gig, it was a bummer. It was like, ah, man. But then looking back and taking the, you know, zooming out, if you will, in retrospect, it's like, hey, man, I think maybe that's the way it was supposed to go.
Well, and sometimes in our industry, the gigs you don't get, you take it as a reflection on you or your capabilities. But the reality is this is the entertainment industry. And sometimes the reason you don't get a gig is because the person that came in after you is a foot taller than you are, or they might have the right look, or they might have smaller cymbals on their kit. Like, you never really know what the scenario is, and you just have to look at it and say, I got something out of this experience, and get excited about that next experience, because you can't let life's experiences discourage you from your path. Sure. I have often heard you say you will never achieve your goal if you have a plan B.
Well, okay, so file that under what I said earlier, which is that's my experience. And I'm not and I've not exactly said that. I just want to clarify slightly. I don't want to say you'll never achieve your goal if you have a plan B. Although I will say that was my personal feeling about myself. I think that there are people in this world who could have completed a mechanical engineering degree and graduated with honors and then hopped in a moving truck and moved to LA and become extremely successful people. That was just not my path. I mean, extremely successful musician, right? That was not my path. I was asked when I was moving, you know, across the country from Boston to LA, I was asked, like, how long are you going to struggle before you give up? And I basically was like, as long as it takes, I guess. Like, I, you know, the older I get, the more I realize how early I held some of the beliefs that I hold. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, that was one of those things. I was like, and there's also this issue of like, people sometimes ask me, if you couldn't be a musician, what would you want to be? And I say, dead. Because I can't imagine doing anything else. Or people will ask me, when did you know you wanted to be a professional musician? And I will say, at no point was I under the impression that I had a choice. It never felt like I had a choice, right? So, you know, in terms of experiences or setbacks or disappointments or whatever, I just kind of felt like, to your point, you know, it's okay. If you learn from it, move on, keep going forward, keep doing what you do. And as I get older and older and closer to the end of my career than the beginning of it, you know, I look back and I think I'm pretty happy with the decisions that I made. And another, so we had, just to fill in your listeners, we had a chat where I said, you know, you get marks for asking things that no one's asked me before. But, and now I'm answering questions that people have asked me before. But another one was, knowing what you know now, what would you tell your younger self?
Mm-hmm.
To which I respond, things have turned out okay for me, so probably nothing. You know, like the setbacks that I would have had ultimately were just as much a part of getting me to where I am as the successes that I had. You know, maybe if I told myself something, it would have been, it's okay to play sports even if you suck. because when I was in high school, I was terrible at sports. I was terrible at basketball, but I enjoyed playing. But because I knew I was terrible, I didn't try out. Or I was fairly terrible at tennis, but I enjoyed playing. But because I knew I was terrible, I didn't try. And I probably could have had fun. So maybe that would be one thing that I would tell myself. But in terms of a career, I'm pretty okay with how things have turned out up to this point.
I think for me, if I was going to tell my younger self something based on my own experiences now, it would be, don't be afraid to take the chance. You will regret the chances you didn't take more than the embarrassment or the stumbles that you had at that particular time when you had those opportunities. So never be afraid to take the chance, because you never know where it can lead you.
I would also tell my younger self, brush your teeth and floss every day, because you have a paralyzing fear of dentists. And you have to go and get a cavity filled. It strikes terror in your heart. So lay off the soda, brush your teeth more, floss more. I would tell my younger self that.
So maybe the all dessert diet is not the best choice.
excellent place, sir. I see what you did there.
So I think that's a fantastic place to end. Nate, it has been an unbelievable experience getting the opportunity to connect with you today. And I wish you all the best of success in your career. And I wish you all of the best of success and joy with your family.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It has been absolutely a pleasure to be here with you, Michael. And I always sort of enjoy opportunities to do things like this, because number one, when I was younger, I didn't have this. I didn't have, you know, podcasts with people that I wanted to gain information from just floating around out there. I couldn't email everybody that I wanted to. I couldn't go on, you know, fill in the blank person's Instagram and DM them, right? So for me to be able to do something like this is, I enjoy the opportunity to provide a certain degree of access to information. You know, because I didn't have that when I was coming up during my formative, if you will, my formative years. So thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure. I absolutely enjoy getting to share.
Absolutely. All the best.
All right, my brother. Talk to you soon, okay?
You've been listening to the Drummer's Pathway podcast. Please share and subscribe, get the word out, and let's keep the discussion going. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.